Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, sponsored by the audiobook edition of Will Eisner, A Spirited Life, now available on iTunes and Audible.com. And the show is recorded live on blogtalkradio.com from the new media and American League Baseball capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I'm a little worried about A.J. Jacobs. His latest book, The Guinea Pig Diaries, My Life as an Experiment, takes the social tests he put himself through in previous books, such as The Know-It-All, in which he read the entire encyclopedia, and The Year of Living Biblically, in which he followed every single rule of the Bible, and reveals a funny, introspective man who may be in danger of becoming a caricature of himself. The Guinea Pig Diaries compiles some of his most brilliant experiments for Esquire magazine, where he's an editor-at-large, and adds in several new trials. It's all good, meaty reading, but I'm starting to wince a little, more than laugh, at some of AJ's escapades. Right now, he's probably wincing listening to this. Where is the line for a man who once outsourced his life to India, but more recently spent a month being whipped, figuratively, I think, by his wife? And how much is too much information for readers about a writer's personal life? Now, don't get me wrong. I am a big fan of AJ's work, a huge fan, and have been for a long time. And if I could have another writer's career, I'd admit to coveting his, little biblical reference. But I do wonder, honestly, if it might not be time for him to point that giant, sensitive brain of his in a different creative direction for a while. And I'm curious to see whether or not he agrees. AJ, welcome back to Mr. Media.
Hey, good to be back. Thank you, Bob.
Not hating me for that now, are you?
I will try to, the Bible says to turn the other cheek, so I will forgive you. But, I have to say, I don't see these as talking about myself as much as taking on a fascinating topic and then trying to get inside it and live it and see what it's like. So I don't think I could ever be bored of talking about something like the role of honesty in our lives or modern relationships or rationality. I mean, these are huge topics, as is the Bible and the encyclopedia. So I think what excites me is looking at these topics and sort of taking them to the extreme and exploring them in a new way.
Mm-hmm. Well, because we've had contact mostly via email since the last time we talked, so you know I continue to be a big fan of your work. But I'm wondering, though, if putting yourself in the middle of these things, if maybe it's time to, take a break from that a little bit. I think they're fascinating subjects. And anything that you put pen or, I should say, computer keyboard to, I'm going to read. But maybe it's in the book because there's so many experiments rather than, you read Living Biblically or The Know-It-All and it's one subject and you read it through and then you go on. I don't know. I just felt like maybe it's time to back a little off of so much AJ and more, I don't know. I guess I'm probably in the minority on this.
Well, we'll see. So far, people have been enjoying it, but maybe you're right. Maybe I'm ready to do it. I mean, I certainly, the thing is, I am loving doing what I do, and I get to explore these fascinating topics, and hopefully the results are interesting to people. So.
Is it a matter of I guess I'm asking you to read into my mind here, but reading them all back to back to back, as opposed to seeing them once every, maybe 2 to 3 months in, say, Esquire, maybe that's what it is. Maybe I just felt kind of an AJ overload after getting to the end of the book.
Well, you got to spread it out there. Read a chapter every couple of days.
That would be your prescription, Dr. Jacobs?
Yeah, maybe for you, exactly.
For me. Well, now, have you done since finishing this book and knowing the timelines on books, I'm guessing you've probably been done with this for anywhere from 8 to 12 months. Have you done more of this type of experiment? Or I saw on your website you talked about interviewing Joan Jett and you were writing about the Coen brothers. Are you doing other things in between, or are you...
Well, I still consider myself a traditional journalist as well, so I like to alternate between doing these experiments and, you know, doing more traditional articles, like about... I actually don't really like traditional articles, but I like to approach a topic in a new way. So, for instance, when I profiled George Clooney for Esquire, we went on the internet and saw what all of the websites out there said about George Clooney, and I sort of got his reaction. So I would show him a website that said, George Clooney is gay, 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 and he would react. He would say, actually, I'm just gay, gay, I'm the third gay. So that, I enjoy taking a little bit of an angle on a story.
Well, and that's certainly a hallmark of things in Esquire. I was thinking about this afternoon. I apologize. You'll know who I'm talking about in a minute. The recent cover story, the interview with Gerard Butler. Who wrote that? Do you recall?
Huffman. Yeah, I really enjoyed that one.
It was just hysterical. I read parts of that out loud, and I got to the end of it, and I was thinking, you know, Cal did a great job with this, especially when you find out what you do about him. But and there I was thinking, I wonder how AJ would have handled this. How different would it have been with AJ?
Well, I did see 300, so I wouldn't have been able to. The conceit of the profile, by the way, for those who didn't read it, was that Cal knew nothing about this actor whatsoever, and he went in to interview him, and he said right up front, I know absolutely nothing about you, which is, a little jarring for a celebrity to hear because they're so used to having their butt kissed.
Right, and Butler, for a while, when they were together, still couldn't quite believe that this guy did not know anything about him, just thought this is crazy. And of course, in the situations as you have there, and as you did with Mary Louise Parker, and when you've done the Woman of the Year type of thing, the Sexiest Woman of the Year, you wind up with a different approach and a different story than someone who's going in doing a 30-minute interview with the publicist sitting next to them, and it's very different. And you have a luxury there. I hope that you guys continue to with the changing economy. You have a luxury at Esquire to do more experimental things like that. Anyway, let's come back to the book. I didn't mean to go so far. Sorry. How many of the chapters in the book come from Esquire? I think there was just I'm guessing there was just one from Entertainment Weekly.
About half are Esquire articles, and half are new projects that I undertook.
And with the new ones, I know Whipped was new. I'm thinking The Unitasker and George Washington.
That's right, exactly. So, and these are, just to give a little background for anyone who's not familiar, I try to do these radical self-improvement projects to learn about myself, see how I can make my life better. So, for instance, I want to learn about honesty. I try out this movement called Radical Honesty, where they believe you should never, ever lie. But more than that, whatever's on your brain should come out of your mouth. So I tried that for a month, and it was wild and horrible, but very enlightening. Or the Unitasker, which you just mentioned, was that I am incredibly distracted, and I think, like most people in America, I multitask all the time. And this is not a small problem. This is, you know, I've come to see it as the 11th plague, that these, it makes us, it lowers our IQ by 10 points, according to one study. It makes us less moral. I mean, it is a real problem. So I try to completely cut multitasking out of my life. and that was the unitasker, which turned out to be a fascinating month and one that changed my life, hopefully forever. We'll see. I'm not multitasking right now. I'm just talking to you.
Thank you.
Answering email. Sure.
And what would George Washington do? Where you try to follow rules that George Washington set forth, and everything from standing upright and the way you would look at a person and behave. Was that was unique to the book, right?
That's true. That one came about just because I became fascinated with George Washington and wanted to see if it was true that there was a more civil way of living than we have now, because this seems a particularly uncivil time. So this was attempt. It was sort of a radical etiquette experiment.
Radical honesty. I mean, I know that originally appeared in Esquire, and that was. I mean, that had me falling down laughing the first time I read it, and still again the second time I read it. You know, saying exactly what you're thinking, and then the founder of that movement was not real happy with you at times. Did he ultimately come around, or is he still doesn't think that you're quite putting everything into it?
No, we're actually we're on friendly terms. But yeah, he was angry at me several times. I mean, at one point, he is just hardcore. He'll tell anyone anything. You know, he'll tell you you're ugly. He'll tell you that you know, he wants to sleep with you. Anything comes out of his mouth. So he is about as extreme as they get. And he, at one point, I was having a conflict because this nice elderly man sent me some poems and asked me what I thought of them. And he was a widower, and you know, he just wanted a little ray of hope. Unfortunately, the poems were terrible. So I was faced with this conundrum. And the Radical Honesty founder, this psychologist in Virginia, he said, you got to tell them, you got to, you know, be cruel, you know, brutally honest. It's more compassionate to be brutally honest and tell them how terrible the poems are than to, you know, than to pretend they're good. But I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't go out there and break this man's heart. So he got very angry at me, the founder. But he has forgiven me.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that. Now, and for something like that, AJ, I mean, do you, you know, as we're talking today, you know, would you like to, are you thinking about using radical honesty in this conversation, or are you not adhering to it in that way? I guess what I'm asking is, what did you take away from that you've kept?
I have kept some radical honesty, not all radical honesty. I call it sustainable radical honesty, because I don't think that you can do it. I mean, this guy, he's great, but he's been married 5 times, you know, and he works for himself. I don't know if he can hold a job. But one thing I'm radically honest about is my own flaws. I've become much more open about those, because I feel it's so liberating, you know, and instead of trying to pretend to be perfect or make up excuses, I'm just, you know, I screwed up, and I'm sorry, and that's the way it is. Or instead of, you know, trying to find someone to blame it on, it's just a very liberating feeling. And so I've kept that, and that's changed my life for the better. A lot of it has to do with remembering what you lied about, which is very stressful for me, you know, trying to think of what you told Paul and what you told Peter, and now, you know, I have less of that, so it's a much better way to live.
One of the things in there that, I mean, there are so many interesting things that you were straightforward about. I've got this open in front of me here. You say at one point, when I get home, I keep the momentum going. I call a friend to say that I fantasize about his wife. And then parentheses, he says he likes my wife too and suggests a key party. I mean, it's kind of hard to move back from stuff like that, isn't it, after a while?
Well, yeah, you know, that's a problem. Men think about sex a lot. So if you're going to be radically honest, you're going to be talking about sex. So there is a fine line between being radically honest and being creepy.
Well, yeah, right, and you say that. And, of course, in the next line, you talk about that you inform your nanny, the ever-popular Michelle, that if my wife left me, I would ask you out on a date because I think you're stunning. And, if, you know, again, there are certain things that you do in these experiments that are going to live with you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, that one I feel pretty bad about, and, I think she's forgiven me. But also there's a sense that, now that's out there. She knows that I find her stunning, and so there's there's sort of a level of openness there that's kind of nice.
No uncomfortable pauses when she and you are the only ones in the home.
Well, I have I make sure that I don't say anything untoward. So now I think that. That the crisis has passed.
Now she did okay because she warranted a whole chapter in the book.
That's right. There's a chapter about her because she is a stunning. Our babysitter is just beautiful, and you know a lot of my friends tell my wife, you know, what are you thinking about? But my wife is very secure, and she also knows that I have no shot at going out with because. As I say in the article, it's sort of like, she's actually given me permission to go out with our babysitter, but it's like giving me permission to be a linebacker for the Miami Dolphins. There's just no way that it's ever going to happen. So, but I wanted to find out, I wanted to set her up. I wanted to find her a boyfriend because she's single. And she gave me permission to go on Match.com and put up a profile. And she didn't like answering the emails or writing the emails, but she thought it would be, if I could do that, then she would go out to coffee with the guys. So I sort of became her Cyrano, and it was fantastic. It was one of the greatest few weeks of my life because she is so, so gorgeous. Her picture was up there. So every day I would get dozens of emails from people telling me how hot I was. And I knew that they weren't technically for me. But still, when you're getting that much positive feedback, it's hard not to be, it's hard not to feel good.
Plus, you got to correct a few men on their approach to women.
Mm. Well, it was a totally unique opportunity because I got to see what men are really like when they're trying to pick up women because I sort of got to be a woman for a few weeks. And there were quite a few men, who would, there were some very wonderful men out there, but they're also the expected sleazeballs. So there's a man who would say, their opening line would be, I'm not a gynecologist, but I'd be happy to take a look. You know, that kind of thing, I sort of would have to. I felt it was my responsibility to tell them this is not the way to get women.
And I want to come back to the unitasker. Now, that came about for a very specific reason, I think a little differently than some of the other experiments, right? I mean, something actually happened in your life that made you seriously
That's
think
right.
about this.
I was driving with my wife to a wedding, and we were listening to a book, a Walter Isaacson's biography of Albert Einstein, which is a terrific book and maybe too terrific because I got so wrapped up in it that I lost, I stopped paying attention to the road, and we actually got in an accident. We jumped the highway median into oncoming traffic. No one was hurt, but it was sort of a wake-up call that, this is, it's not only bad for you, it's not only bad for productivity, but it's dangerous. Multitasking is dangerous. So that is how I started that project.
Mm. And are you back to driving? Are you allowed to drive the family at any time now, or is the arrangement still in place?
I'm allowed to drive myself, but I'm not allowed to drive the family. My wife is now our official driver because, yeah, I'm still on probation. But it was an amazing. I really loved that experiment because I did gain some techniques in stopping this stuff, and I did realize how harmful it is. And the techniques range from sort of the extreme to the really, useful. At one point, I started wearing a blindfold while I was talking on the phone because it's just too tempting to have the email staring at you and beckoning. And it actually did help. It changed the quality of the conversation. When I was talking to my parents and just talking to them, it was like, oh, this is what it was like. This is what it used to be like to be on the phone. You know, I hadn't just been on the phone in years.
I wanted to ask you sort of about that in a general way. Are there things over the course of these many experiments, going back to the know-it-all and living biblically, are there things that you've learned about yourself that surprised you and also that frightened you?
Well, one of the things that surprised me, I think, is just how easily my mind goes to the negative. And I don't think I'm alone. I think it's unfortunately a human trait. You know, you think about someone, through the course of the day, you hear 100 nice things, and that one nasty thing is the one that sticks in your brain. And there are evolutionary reasons for this. It is the way our mind was built, but it's not conducive to happiness. And so that's one of the things I tried to address in this experiment I did on trying to be the most rational person alive and trying to really to think rationally about every decision. And one of the things I realized is that, you know, I remember all the bad things. And, you know, you remember, for instance, every time you're on the grocery line and it's really slow and there's a guy paying in pennies in front of you and how frustrating that is. But you never remember the many more times when you just go straight through or there's just one person in front of you. So it's you have to make a conscious effort to pay attention to everything that goes right. So that was one of the major lessons of that. And it's also related to some lessons on gratitude that I learned from the year of living biblically.
Now, speaking of gratitude, I remember one of the things we talked about back on when you were promoting the year of living biblically was I was saying how amazed I was with Julie, your wife, and the things that she puts up with. And you know, you touch on this a few times in this book because in order to be living with someone who puts himself through the year-long or month-long, whatever it may be, experiments that you have to have a very understanding spouse. Now, you give your wife you give your wife her props in this book at the end because she gets a whole chapter basically devoted to whatever in the hell Julie wants.
That's it. That's the chapter called Whipped, the ultimate
yeah.
Whipped man. So, this one was sort of to repay Julie for all the pain I put her through. And this is actually an idea from readers. A lot of readers emailed in and suggested I do this. And it was a painful month for me. You know, it was the expected foot massages, and there were the Kate Hudson movies, but and Julie, I think she would tell you herself, she sort of got drunk with power. I think anyone would. If you have this person who's, you know, basically willing to do anything, willing to do your bidding. So, you know, she basically used me as a human remote control. I had to get up and change the volume on the television, things like that. But there were also positives that came out of it that I think did improve our relationship. I was not allowed to complain or bicker or whine, which was crazy. You know, that's like, you know, I've been married 10 years. That's a lot of our interaction. So it was really fascinating to see what happens when you take that completely out. And And it was almost like a vicious cycle of niceness. You know, I was forced to be nice to her. I couldn't say anything, even though, you know, I really wanted to sometimes. And in return, she would be nice to me. And it was sort of this, you know, it was like a snowball effect of positivity. You know, there really is something to it.
Is, you know, anyone else, I would never ask this question, but so much of your life is out there on the printed page. Was this, you know, was this month for Julie, was it good for your personal life with her?
Well, I talk about that a bit in the book. It's, yeah, she, she likes the once a week. That's the schedule we're on. That's too much information. But there you go. That's she's like, you know, we have lots of three young kids, and that's plenty.
Yeah.
In fact, she at one point, and I write a little bit about this in the book, I found this device on the internet that I never knew existed, a chastity belt for men. And I thought it was so interesting because, you know, if she's going to be in control of my life, you know, it would be interesting if she could also control my private parts. So I did order one of those for her, and I did strap it on for a couple of days. And, you know, it was interesting because that was when I realized, you know, it's hard to shock her. It's getting harder to shock her because she was sort of like, oh, all right, he's wearing a chastity belt. That's interesting. But she did learn to enjoy that as well. She liked the idea of being master of the domain, so to speak.
Now, I'm not going to surprise you because I'm sure I'm not the first to point out that a lot of guys reading this probably think she already was in control of your private parts.
Well, it is it was an interesting experiment because I do believe I'm already sort of 70%. She's the boss 70% of the way. So this is sort of taking it to the 100% level, which is a significant difference. But yeah, I think that it's a valid argument.
So would you say that you do these things so the rest of us don't have to?
Sure. I mean, I hope that I just love doing them. And yeah, I mean, I've been told that by many readers that thank me for doing it for them, and it's sort of a vicarious thrill to read about it. But also, I hope that people do experiment with their own lives, because I think it's a great way to live. You know, it's so easy to get caught in ruts, and to really improve your life, I think there is something to experimentation. And you don't have to do it to the extreme, but you can do something like, a week without complaining, and see how it really affects your life, and I guarantee you, you'll take away from that something permanent. It will change the way you think. So I do encourage it as this. You know, there is an element of self-help to this book. It's hopefully entertaining, but I wanted to have, you know, some lessons that people can apply to their own lives.
Well, folks, listen, you can find A.J. Jacobs' latest book, The Guinea Pig Diaries, My Life as an Experiment, at great bookstores everywhere, alongside The Year of Living Biblically and The Know-It-All. Or you can find it online at MrMedia.com or Amazon.com. You can also find A.J. online at AJJacobsSolid, AJJacobs.com, or on Twitter at AJJacobs, Twitter.com/AJJacobs, and he's also on Facebook. And now I have to ask you, radical honesty here. When I started the show, were you thinking I wanted to be anywhere but here right now? And is it any better getting it to the end now?
Well, yeah, I enjoyed the parts where you praised me. That's the part. That I don't know about the parts where you were questioning me. I think you read me too often. That's the problem. You need to you study me. You got to take a break. Stop obsessing about me, please.
I think, you know what, I think you're right, AJ, because, you know, I mean, like I said, you know this, I love your work. I think you're right, though. I think I need a little break. I will wait for the next issue. Are you in the, what do you have coming up in Esquire before you go? What should we look for?
I have, I wrote an essay about the Coen brothers. They have a new movie coming out, and they're sort of the philosophy of life of the Coen brothers. And so it's a little bit about some of the stuff I mentioned earlier, about just, you know, appreciating the little things, which you don't expect in a Coen brothers movie. You know, they're known for being dark and negative and cynical and pessimistic. But I found these glimmers of optimism in their movies. So I talk about that.
Very good. I always like it when any time when George Clooney smiles in one of their movies, and I know things are going to be okay.
He's very handy.
Listen, AJ, it is always a pleasure. I hope I haven't scared you off from coming back with the next book, but thanks so much for joining us at Mr. Media today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bob.
All right, good luck to you.
Thanks. You too.
Bye-bye. And folks, for more interviews with your favorite journalists and authors, you can surf over to our main website, www.mrmedia.com. That's where you can listen to my earlier conversation with AJ, as well as interviews with John Darton of the New York Times, former Washington Post reporter Peter Carlson, 2009 Pulitzer Prize winner for features Lane DeGregory, Washington Post reporter Philip Sheenon, Writer's Digest publisher Jane Friedman, and many more. And please think about writing an online review of Mr. Media, casting a vote for Mr. Media, or marking Mr. Media as one of your favorites, whether you listen on Blog Talk Radio, TrueSlant, Digital Journal, Vox, Podcast Pickle, MediaFly, Podfeed.net, Blueberry, Zencast, Zimbio, Current, or Odeo. And subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. Or subscribe to Mr. Media's blog on the Amazon Kindle Reader. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com/andelman. Thank you so much for joining us today. Always appreciate when you give up a piece of your day and share it with Mr. Media. Thanks for listening, everybody.